Thank you, Janice, and I'd like to thank the group for asking and allowing me to share my experience, strengths, and hope with you. And before I get started, I just had some kind of bad news. A good friend of mine from Area 48 passed away, and I want to thank Bill for carrying the message to me so I know. And I'd like to ask all you to have him in his prayers. His name is George. And, you know, folks, it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at a group. And I'm always at all that people would want to hear what I've got to say. You know, you're going to hear me say some things, and I'll clear up a couple things first. If you hear me talk about a lead meeting, folks, that means it's a speaker meeting, and that's what it is in the area I'm in, and that's what it is where I've been all my life. A speaker meeting's been a lead meeting to me all my AA life. So I want you to understand, then you'll have some idea what I'm talking about if I say a speaker meeting in this. The big book tells, I'm an alkie, and I'm Bob, and I'm only sober today by the grace of God and a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the first 164 pages of our big book, The Doctor's Opinion and Dr. Bob's Story. As I said earlier, this is my online home group. My face-to-face home group is the Monday Night Men's. It meets at 8:30 p.m. in Toledo, Ohio, on Monday night. And my sobriety date's April 5th, 1968. And that's only by the grace of God and one day at a time. And this fellowship, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, not my program. My program got me here. The AA program has kept me here. Tells us that we're supposed to tell a little bit of how it was, what happened, and how it is today. Yeah, I was born in a little town in the mountains of northwest Georgia, and my mother and father came over from Germany, and I'm not sure today how they ended up down there, but they ended up there somehow, and that's where I was born, and my two brothers was born there, and my sister was born in Ohio. That's where we moved to after when I was 11 years old, and I personally think I had a normal life as a kid. I don't know if I ever blamed my parents for what happened to me as an alcoholic or not, but I'm sure I did, because I blamed everybody and everything except for me. I didn't want to accept the responsibility of what I was and who I was. So all my life, before I picked up the drink, I was a person that had a lot of tendencies of alcoholism. I've always had trouble telling the truth, and it's a lot better today, thank goodness for that. You know, and I did some things that were crazy in my life. I said that I was born in Georgia, and in our home, we spoke German, and so I developed a German accent with a North Georgia drawl. And it was, I guess I sounded kind of funny, because when I, at 11 years old, my parents decided to move to Ohio, because they had some relatives up here, and so we moved up here. And the first thing that happened to me was, and all I'm doing is trying to show some of my alcoholic tendencies that I had. We moved up here, and people laughed at me with the little accent I had, my German accent with the North, and then that old North Georgia drawl in there. And I didn't like people laughing at me. So I developed my own language. My mother got to a point where she could understand me, but I think she was the only one that knew what I was talking to other than myself. And consequently, they had to take me to a speech therapist, and I had to go through. I actually learned to talk again. One of the things that happened after that was that my father said we would no longer speak German in our home, and we would speak speak English. Everybody would speak English. Because he thought that had something to do with what I was, the problem I had, which I don't think it had a thing to do with it. It was just that it was my way of showing the world that I was different, you know. And a couple people have heard me say that, you know, I was born and raised in Georgia back in the late 30s and early 40s. And when I got up north, I was prejudiced. And I stayed prejudiced until I came into AA. If you were any different from me, then there was something wrong with you. You were inferior to me. But anyway, you know, the first time that I drank on my own, and maybe I should tell you this, at meals we were allowed to have either a glass of beer or a glass of wine with our meal. And that was from the time, as early as I can remember. But the first time I went out and drank without the supervision of my parents and right in the home was a disaster. And my drinking from that point on just became more of a disaster. You see, I went to it was a wedding of some friends of ours, and I got smashed, and they had to pour me on my porch. And that wedding happened to be in November. It gets kind of cold sometimes in Ohio in November. And it was a cold, rainy night or early morning. And my dad came out of the house to go to work and stumbled over me. I heard about it. Let's put it that way. And my dad wasn't above spanking in us. I didn't really have a whole lot of problem with drinking. I mean, I drank in high school, but I didn't get in trouble or anything. And that was probably the only part of my life that drinking was somewhat normal. I mean, I didn't like the way I felt after that incident with my getting poured on the porch and my dad explaining the facts of life to me. I didn't like the consequences. So I got through high school fine. I was active in sports. And I've been blessed all my life, folks. I've been blessed all my life. And until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know it. I thought the only thing it was that I deserved everything that I got that was good, and anything that was bad, then there was something wrong with that. I won a football scholarship to Ohio State University, and my first year there went pretty good, but, from the time school was out until the time we went back to, started back to school and got into football camp, I drank quite a bit, had a lot of fun. I blew a knee out, and at the end of my second year of playing, and back then they didn't have the medical knowledge that they have today, and they didn't fix knees or do things like that. So I did what all good alcoholics did, you know, and something happened that they didn't know how to handle. I drank. Consequently, I drank myself right out of school. For years, people old enough to remember the draft, my grades went down, my deferment was taken away, and I got drafted and went in the Army. Right from the beginning, I realized the Army was a great place. I got paid once a month in those days, went out and got drunk, drank up all my money, come back, and I was taken care of. I mean, you know, my food was taken care of, all my medical things were taken care of, I had a place to sleep. It was an ideal life for an alky. I'd have one big drunk a month, and that was it. And the rest of the month, I got by. Did well in the service my drinking progressed, and in the meantime I had got married, and we went to Alaska and had two children was born. The girl I married was my high school sweetheart, and things went real well. And then that drinking just kind of, you know, started getting away of me doing my job in the service. I stayed up in Alaska 2.5 years, and I really loved it up there. I had a great time, but I came back to the States, and I ended up in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. got started to have some problems. I'd had a pretty good record, I had a good record up until then in the service. They overlooked some little minor things that happened, like I'd come back late from a 3-day pass, or I'd miss a reveille formation. And then I got orders for my first tour of duty in Vietnam. And I went, did the tour over there as an advisor. This was in 1960 and 61. I was there. While I was there, my father passed away, and for no blame on the Army or anything, they tried to get a hold of me, but we just weren't where they could have get a hold of me and let me know about my father dying. And when I got back, they told me, you know, I got to notice that he had passed away, and you know, I did the only thing a drunk knows what to do. I drank. Drank for 3 days, and never really grieved for my father. Maybe some of that was his fault, and most of it was mine. I was raised that big boys didn't cry, and big boys didn't show pain, or big boys didn't show emotions. That was okay for women, but it wasn't okay for big boys. And, well, I finished my tour over there and got back, and came back to the States, and I got put in as a training cadre in jump school. I was in the airborne and in the special forces. But anyway, I didn't do too well in that. I ran into some scrapes with different people that I let the power of being cadre, the power of being an NCO, go to my head, and you know, I had to exercise my authority, and I always didn't exercise it in a good manner. And so anyway, I got sent back to Vietnam again for the second time. This time it was a little different. We weren't advisors over there. We were combat troops, and things, you know, happened over there that I carried with me for a lot of years. Got back to the States again, and just basically the same thing happened. Just a series of minor incidents in the service. You know, I got a couple Article 14s. I didn't get busted yet. But I had our battalion commander tell me that if he could keep me in combat overseas at the time, because the Vietnam War was going strong then, that I might make general. You know, he was kind of joking with that, but some of it was truth. I did well over there, and then I come back to the States, and I didn't do so well. I went back on my third tour, and first time, other than a couple of scratches, they shot my butt off, and I spent a number of months in a VA hospital, and can't complain about the care I had and what they'd done for me. They helped me out. Went back and finished my tour out, and came back to the States again, and it was time for me to reenlist, because I'd already made my mind up I was going to make a career out of the Army. And I got to watch the time. I don't want to talk too much on this drunk log. I came back here and tried to reenlist, and they just flatly said that they thought that the Army and the country would be better that I wasn't in the service any longer. So they didn't allow me to reenlist. I didn't get kicked out or anything, but they just wouldn't allow me to reenlist at the time. And then this was when Vietnam was full blown, and well, they were dying to get people over there, and they were dying especially to get people that had combat experience. But anyway, they gave me a discharge, and I went home, and my marriage wasn't going too good at that time either. And you see, I always had a problem, and I couldn't face situations and take care of them like an adult. And I didn't know how to take care of situations. So anyway, I did some things. I made my wife leave me, you know, with my actions. And it was done deliberately. I did it deliberately. I just didn't go out and do them. I knew what I was doing. And so consequently, we got divorced. And I did exactly, you know, worked like an alcoholic. The day of my divorce, I left the court, walked across the street. There was a bar right across the street from the courthouse, called the courthouse bar, and I proceeded to get drunk. This was on a Thursday afternoon. Monday morning, I wake up, I'm married again. I knew this girl. I mean, it wasn't that I didn't know her, but I sure wasn't planning on marrying her. I abused that woman a lot, and she was really an angel, and she was a good wife. And let me say this, I've married, this is my fourth time. It wasn't until this time that I realized that it wasn't the women that were wrong, that there was something wrong with me. But anyway, she put up with a lot of stuff from me. I was abusive, emotionally and physically, to her. I was abusive emotionally to the kids. I didn't physically abuse them, but emotionally I did. I didn't realize it, but I did. And consequently, things didn't go too well for me. I had trouble holding jobs down. I always thought I knew more than the people I worked for. And I forgot one basic thing in life, folks. Whether the person you work for, the boss, is right or wrong, they're always the boss. And when they sign the paycheck, you know, you do what they tell you to do and how they tell you to do it. Whether you agree, disagree, or what. So consequently, I, you know, job after job after job. I think in that period of time, which was about 2 years, I must have held 10 different jobs. I don't remember some of the jobs I had, I'll be perfectly honest with you. And my drinking progressively got worse, and my abusiveness got worse, and it finally got to the point where I couldn't work any longer. First of all, nobody would hire me. Very, very few people would hire me. They all said I'd do a good job, but then I always would engage my mouth sometimes before I'd engage my brain, and I'd end up getting fired. Or usually I never waited to get fired. I always left. Because, see, I couldn't face the idea of going to that boss and telling them, hey, look, I don't think this is going to work out too well for either one of us. Maybe we better separate, you know. What I just do, I just didn't show up and didn't go to work. And consequently, they fired me. And there was jail time in this thing, and there was, you know, in that period of time, I went to the state hospital twice. I was committed due to my alcoholism. But see, I couldn't see that I had a problem. Everybody else in the world had a problem, but not Bob. Bob didn't have that problem. Oh, I'm going to speed this up a little bit, folks. I ended up getting in some trouble with the law. Guy that I ran around and drank with, we decided to, he worked out at one time at the Port of Toledo, and the ships would come in and drop off stuff, and they used to bring in Scotch whiskey, and they had a whole trailer load of Scotch whiskey there, and he said he knew how to get that. And you know, a drunk always needs money, especially a drunk that wasn't working, that was living off his wife. And so we went and got that. He actually stole the tractor. We drove it into the Port of Toledo, hooked that tractor up to a trailer load of Scotch, and away we went. Got away with it with no problem whatsoever. We're going down the road. He had found a guy down in Lima that he could sell the whole load to. Well, I don't know, we got down the road maybe 30 or 50 miles, and there was a little side cut park, and we pulled in there and decided we wanted to make sure we didn't want to sell this guy bad whiskey. So we got into the whiskey, and the next thing I remember is a state trooper standing over me with a gun and telling me to put my hands behind my back. And I got convicted of a federal offense and went to a federal penitentiary for, I served a little over 3 years there. And while I was serving the time, I had a job where I had the opportunity to make a lot of booze around there, and so I was a pretty popular guy. And I always had plenty of spending money because people paid me off to give them something to drink. And I don't know what your Aussies calls it, but we called it Applejack. It was made out of apples and raisins and stuff, but it would do the job. It'd get you drunk. Well, I served my time, got out. And I went home, and I knew my wife was acting a little odd at the time. And, you know, I did what all good alcoholics do. I went out and got drunk for 3 days. I came back home, and you know, I'm telling my story, so I tell some things I'm not very proud of today. I beat the hell out of her. And 2 days later, there was a knock on the door, and the sheriff handed me a restraining order that I was no longer allowed in my own home. And that was the beginning of the end to my drinking. I drank for a while after that. I won't tell you, I quit right away. And got one more scrape with the law after that. You see, one of the things that not only the alcohol I was addicted to, but I was addicted to that lifestyle, the neons and the nylons. And consequently, I wasn't too faithful to my wife for a lot of the time there until I got sober. And I ended up at this woman's house, and I had a couple of guns on me, and she happened to see them, and she called the law, and the law came, and we had a big standoff, and I won't go through the whole thing. But anyway, when it was all over, I ended up, they sent me to the state hospital again for a short period of time. And then I went in front of a judge, and he bowled me over to the grand jury with, I think it was 42 counts. Total against me. And now I'm broke. I don't have, I'm not living anywhere. I'm living on the street. I have nothing. And just by the luck of the draw, I got one of the very best criminal attorneys in the United, and not the United States probably, but at least in Ohio at that time. And this guy was good. I'll say that for him. He got everything knocked down to a misdemeanor while carrying a weapon while impaired. I end up with a total of 9 months. I'd already served 3 waiting to go to trial. So I had 6 months to do, which meant with a little less than 5 months, I'd get out if I, you know, good behavior. And I did. I got out. But I continued to drink, and I couldn't go home. I was sleeping in the back of a tavern. And back then, they had the beer, the long-neck returnable bottles. I was sleeping under beer cases. The guy that owned the bar would give me a couple of these infrared sandwiches every day to eat. All the draft beer I could drink, and a couple of bottles of wine. And that's how I lived for about 3 months. And it got to a point where I could no longer manage what I had become. You know, my unmanageability in the first step was simply because I could no longer look in the mirror without puking. And, you know, some people regurgitate, some people throw up. Well, I was a puker, man, and that's exactly what I did. And and somewhere in the jail time that I had done and the time that I had done in the state hospital, I'd run across AA, and I don't remember where, folks, because so much of my drinking was blackout time that it's hard to give you years, you know, or state years when I talk about something, let alone days and hours and minutes. But anyway, I knew about AA, and I stumbled down the street one morning after I drank all the draft beer I could put in my stomach and 2 bottles of white port, and to this AA meeting, and walked around outside for quite a while. I didn't want to go in when everybody was standing outside talking. And gradually that crowd thinned out. And I went in, and there was this little old guy. At the door. And he shook my hand and said, "Welcome." And boy, that was something. No one had welcomed me ever anywhere in a long time. And he walked me in, and he took me to the front row and set me down all by myself. He went and got a half a cup of coffee. And in those days, they didn't have the styrofoam cups. They was using the big white porcelain mugs. And he filled it about half full because he seen how I was shaking. He came over and said, "Look," he said, "I know it's going to be hard." He said, "But you sit here and you shut up. And you listen to the best of your ability for this until this meeting's over, and then I'll come and talk to you." Well, somehow I was able to do that. And somehow I was able to see that there just might be some hope for me. This was a speaker meeting. It was the guy's anniversary, and he was celebrating 5 years sober. And the first thing I realized about AA was I knew I was in the right place, because this guy was a liar just like I was. Because there's no way in hell that you're going to go 5 years without a drink. But anyway, I listened to him, and I did get this little ray of hope, because after the meeting, some people came over and talked to me, even though I smelled pretty bad. And I was not clean. And then the little old guy come up to me and said, he was always blunt with me, but this was probably the bluntest he ever was. He said, "Look," he says, "I'll be your sponsor until you find somebody that you want more than me, if you want to stay sober." He said, "Now, if you don't want to stay sober," he says, "don't waste my time." And, you know, I really didn't know, I'll be honest with you, if I wanted to stay sober or not. But I knew I wanted something to change in my life. And gradually, you know, and so I said, "Okay." And we talked a little bit, and he asked me where I was living, and I told him, and he said, "You can't stay there." He said, you'll be drunk tonight." And he was right, I would have been. So he took me home and put me in his basement, and his wife would allow me upstairs. I mean, he had done this prior to that. It wasn't just me. It was just that through the years, they found out it was best to put people in the basement that he brought home. And so I stayed down in that basement for 3 months until I got a job and was able to get a room. But in that 93 months or 90 days, we worked the steps, all of them. And I said, we worked them because I couldn't have done it on my own. You know, I could read a paragraph and couldn't tell you what one sentence said in it. But we did this. We went through this, and he sat down, and if it wasn't him, it was one of the guys that he hung around with. They went through the DTs with me. I'd used up getting in any hospital because I didn't have any money, and I didn't have any insurance, and I'd been in and out of so much, and it was always for being dead drunk and sick. But anyway, I started on this long road of growing up. At that first meeting, one of the guys that hung out with my sponsor at that time said to me, kid, don't you think it's about damn time you grow up? And, of course, I said to this guy in a few choice words what he could do with his growing up and that I was a man. And what I was legally of age. I was 29 years old. I'd used up family and friends, but I wasn't a man. That took some doing. But anyway, I started out in that long ride of sobriety, and what a ride it's been. I've had great things happen to me since I've been here. My sponsor was very active in service. He never went a whole way, but he was active in his local home group and mine. He was active at the district level and the area level. So consequently, I got introduced to the service structure of AA. Got to a lot of meetings in a lot of different places. His district was the outlying areas of Toledo, Ohio, and we went to cities like Bowling Green, Fremont, Port Clinton, Sandusky, Genoa, just all over northwestern part of Ohio and even up into southeast Michigan. Well, consequently, I got to meet a lot of people quick, and I got a lot of variety of AA, but I stuck with the guys that stuck with the program. Somehow I knew that if I would go and pick the people to hang with, that I'd pick some jerk just like me. And consequently, you've got to put the old life away. That old life has to die. And a new life will begin. One of the great paradoxes of our program. You know, Gordy tells a story that there was a guy that talked about throwing the towel in for the prize fighter. When you throw the towel in at a boxing match, the person loses. But when we throw the towel in AA, we win. Folks, we win. You know, in the years that I was in AA, I stayed in service most of the time, was finally fortunate enough to become delegate from Area 55, which is my area here, to the General Service Conference in New York. I was able to serve my area, and it was good for me. It was good for me. You see, being in service, I got humble pretty quick because I made a lot of mistakes, and I was called on them, and I realized that I wasn't the center of the universe, that this world didn't revolve around me, that I was just a speck in the big picture. And what a great time that was, and I'd like to tell a little story about where I was at the General Service Conference. There was a gentleman there from a district in Indiana, and this was my first year to go to the conference, and he was getting ready to rotate out. This was his second year there. And we were talking one day, and somebody asked him what he was going to do when he got back to his home group, and he said, well, he said, I'm going to go down to Walgreens. He says, I'm going to buy at least a dozen toothbrushes. I'm going to take them back to my home group, and I'm going to scrub the toilet. And, you know, I got to be honest, that went over my head. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about or why he was doing that. And what he was talking about was one of the things that I was told early on in the service area. That our service structure is completely different than any other organization in the world. Everything starts and ends at the home group. Everything. You know? And the farther away you get from the home group when you're in the service structure, the lower you go on the totem pole. The most important job in AA is the coffee maker at his home group. But anyway, my second year, I realized what this guy was talking about. I came back, and I stayed active in service as far as going to the area meetings, and got to meet a lot of great people, because in my job, when I was still working, I traveled quite a bit, and I got around the country. Anyway, I got to most every state in east of the Mississippi, except for Maine. And at one time or the other. And I think I need to say this. You know, after I got sober, I said after 3 months I got a job. Well, I got a job working for a hotel, a group of people that they ran hotels and that were financially in trouble, and they worked to put them back up to a paying proposition, and then they would turn them back either to the banks or the mortgage company, or someone would buy them, buy the company or the hotel. And I started out there as a dishwasher. And in 1996, when they made me retire due to my health, I was a district supervisor. And I put 26 years together in the same company, and boy, was that. To me, that was amazing. Some of the other great things that happened in my life that showed that I was starting to grow up and on a regular basis was I no longer cheated on my wife. I no longer had a 13th step. Because early on in this program, I was the greatest 13th stepper there was. I took step 1, added it to step 12, and that equaled 13. So one day, four guys backed me into a corner after a meeting and explained what they were going to do to me if I didn't stop my actions with the new women that are coming into the program. You see, I've never done anything to change in this program until it got to a point where I was in trouble with it. I had to be hurting before I quit. Well, anyway, I've talked just about long enough. You know, 3 years ago, I came back home again. And I forgot to mention that in 1990, I met my last wife, and what a blessing that was. She's in the program. We stay out of each other's programs. We leave each other, take care of each other in that way. We're always there for each other. But I don't tell her how to stay sober, and she don't tell me how to be a decent human being. Today I feel that I'm fully recovered from alcoholism. As far as the hopeless body of state and mind, as long as I don't pick up the first drink. But if I pick up that first drink, folks, I'm going to tell you I'll be right back where I was. Except I'll have progressed. You see, I don't know that because I haven't done that, personally. But everybody that I know that goes back out when they come back, I simply one day will get them together and ask them, did it get any better out there? And I know the answer before they tell me because they're back. And the answer is no, it didn't. Or they wouldn't be back. You know, they wouldn't come back with their head stuck between their legs, with their head bowed so low they couldn't see nothing but the ground. They wouldn't come back. They wouldn't have to if it was better out there. I'm thankful for everybody that's in AA today, you know. I'm thankful for the people that keeps going in and out the doors of AA because they're showing me that what I'm doing is working. You see, I don't have to pick up a drink. I don't have to go back to that misery. And the only reason I don't is because of you, of a higher power that I found, God. The first 164 pages of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our textbook. And I haven't had to ask somebody to refund my misery. And that's a total blessing for me. And folks, that's about all I have to say tonight, or today, or tonight, depends where you're at. And I thank you all for being here. I thank each and every one of you for listening to me. And because I truly believe that I can get drunk, but we can stay sober. Left on my own, I'll forget everything that I've read in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous real quick. But you see, by staying around these rooms, whether it's online or face-to-face, which I go to both, I'm still somewhat active in service. I'm now on the local shut-in committee, which we go around to people that are sick or got to the point where they can't get out of their homes, and we take a meeting to them. For this alcoholic, it brings back gratitude for being sober. It keeps that gratitude up. That's all I do anymore in service. Whether I'll get back into it or not, I don't know. It all depends on my health, I guess. But you see, folks, this ride I've had has been the greatest adventure I ever had. And it's been an adventure, folks, because today I'm willing to take that leap of faith into areas that I don't know and don't understand. Knowing that if I'm doing the right thing for the right reasons, that everything's going to be okay. So again, I want to thank each and every one of you for being here because I need each and every one of you. I'll close with my usual statement. I hope you all have a great day unless you made other plans. Janice, thank you for your service today, and thank Gordy and Adrian and whoever else is wearing a hat at this point. I don't know. Thank you all for that. And again, I need to thank each and every one of you for being here because I do need you. Thank you for allowing me to share today. It's a pretty good chance I won't pick a drink up. Giving it back to you, Janice, and thanks again, folks.